More than 10 years into a career in the academic ivory tower, McPherson turned his efforts on social criticism. These efforts continue, with climate change a primary focus of his current work. He's the author of Extinction Dialogue. So thank you, Guy, for your wonderful work, and thank you for being on the program.
Thank you, Derek. I appreciate the opportunity to visit with you today.
So what I would like to do for today is turn this into the Guy McPherson bashing hour, because so far for the past year, it seems that it's been the, 2014 was the year of bashing Guy McPherson, it seems. So
that'd be great. I'd prefer roasting the bashing because it's more consistent with my message. But
oh, there we go. So it's the Guy McPherson roast, just like those old Dean Martin celebrity roasts.
There you go.
And the insults are probably going to make about as much sense as those did back then too. So what I would like to talk about are the main criticisms of your work and. Can you do like a 3-minute version for people who don't actually know your work? Do like the 3 to 5 minute version of your work, and then we're going to go in and start bashing you.
Sure.
Roasting you, sorry.
You know, most people are aware that climate change is underway and that it's anthropogenic in origin, that in general there has been a warming of the planet as a result of industrial civilization. Most people stop right there and fail to recognize that we're not merely in the midst of anthropogenic climate change, we are also in the midst of abrupt climate change, consistent with the kind of abrupt changes in climate that have happened in the geologic past, and that as a consequence of this abrupt warming, we will almost certainly lose habitat for humans and a lot of other organisms within the not very distant future. Within a decade or two, we could see habitat for humans disappear. And so when I talk about things like that, of course, humans are shocked, terrified, and people who live in industrialized societies, especially people in positions of privilege, view this as a very threatening message.
So do you want to go on or do you want me to start roasting?
No, go. Let's go with the roasting.
Okay, so I think one of the critiques I've heard is that, and I want to be clear that none of these critiques are actually substantive and have to do. Oh, wait, before we go there, can you talk for just a moment about one of the reasons that you believe that that the warming will happen so quickly, having to do with what some people call tipping points, what some people call feedback loops, what some people call reinforcement? So those, like the methane, can you talk about that for just a moment first?
Yes, absolutely. We have triggered self-reinforcing feedback loops that feed upon themselves. And so it's no longer simply a matter of tweaking the thermostat so that we can turn down the heat. Rather, the thermostat has run out of control. It's as if the boiler room is capable automatically of fueling itself and bringing more coal into the room without humans being involved at this point. So it's pretty apparent that we have Arctic methane, methane coming out of the Arctic Ocean at a very, very rapid rate, apparently an exponential rate. And so even if we were to stop all industrial activity today, even if we were to remove all humans from the planet today, there is no evidence that we would be able to stop that methane from leaking out of the Arctic Ocean, not to mention the dozens of other places it's coming out of the Earth. And so it's beyond human intervention, apparently, at this point.
And so two things about that. One is that at least one, and I think many of the previous mass extinctions were caused by the release of methane. I know that one of the primary theories on one of them is that a volcano happened to, the lava happened to hit these huge methane beds, which then immediately sent the methane into the air, and that was the genesis of some very rapid warming.
That's right. The Siberian Trap in Siberia, that is noted for permafrost deposits of methane, is responsible for at least one and perhaps two, maybe even three, of the six great extinction events. So probably two in the past, and methane release is likely going to be a primary factor underlying the ongoing sixth great extinction event. So there's a lot of methane on land in the form of permafrost and Siberian traps, and the volcanism that occurred there in the past underlies one of those great extinction events. But then there's methane in a lot of other places, including the relatively shallow Arctic Ocean, continental shelf, for example. So, yeah, it's pretty interesting. Rapid cooling apparently was responsible for three of the six great extinction events, and rapid warming is implicated in the other half, the other three of the great extinction events. And one of those rapid cooling events was apparently a result of an asteroid striking the Earth. It wasn't the asteroid itself that caused the great extinction. It was rather the dramatic cooling, the so-called nuclear winter, that resulted from that asteroid kicking a bunch of particles up into the air and ensuring that there was a profound solar dimming. So, yeah, whether it's cold or hot, if it happens rapidly, organisms can't adapt, and they certainly cannot evolve through the process of natural selection to keep up. And so that's where we're at right now, with general warming of the planet already proceeding at a rate 10,000 times faster than evolution by natural selection, and accelerating even as we speak.
The reason I wanted to bring up those self-reinforcing loops is that all the criticisms that I've seen of your work, and this is actually true of my work too, all the criticisms I've seen of your work are not on substantive issues. All the criticisms are basically emotional, that because I don't like what you're saying, then you must be wrong. As opposed to somebody saying, well, it ends up that your science is inaccurate on, you know, action A or action B. I have not actually seen anybody challenge you on the release of methane, for example.
Right. And so what I do is quote the science, and I'm very careful to do this. I've been out of active service at the university for nearly 6 years now, so I'm not doing primary research anymore. Instead, what I'm doing is secondary research. So I rely upon the work of other people, and I transmit that work to the general public. And so it's hard to take issue when the science, or it's hard to take issue with the science when what I'm presenting is just other people's science. So then, if you can't attack the science, that only leaves the messenger.
Okay, which seems like a good segue into going ahead and attacking the messenger. So one of the primary complaints that I've heard about your work is that they either say that you are too gloomy personally, or you must just be a gloomy person, or B, that, you know, nobody wants to hear doom and gloom. And while I may personally agree with what you're saying, when I try to talk about it, people tell me to shut up. So I think that you're actually not delivering a hopeful message, because when people hear your message, then they just get depressed and then they can't do anything. So that's sort of a combination of three or four of the ones that I've heard.
Right, as if you and I are responsible for the response of other individuals to evidence that we present, right? As if telling a 10-year-old that Santa Claus isn't real, that it's just a myth that we perpetuated for a while, as if telling the 10-year-old that is the wrong thing to do. You know, at some point we have to give up on the Easter Bunny and Santa Claus and these other myths that for many people are profoundly important in their lives. But adhering to those myths long after they are pointed out as being myths is not beneficial. You know, you can imagine if some person in their 30s showed up in the corporate boardroom and their whole life depends upon them selling advertising and all of the things that are wrong with this culture, and they showed up at the corporate board meeting where they're going to talk about advertising, and he starts going on about Santa Claus being real. Well, people would think he was insane. As long as there were people older than 5 years old in the room. And so we think some myths are okay, and it's actually important to maintain them in the early years of somebody's life. But then we're going to get over them. And we believe as a society that for the most part, honesty is the best policy. But then we don't actually act that way when presented evidence for dire outcomes, for example.
So you and I have talked before about the doctor analogy here. And can you speak to that in terms of when people say that you're too gloomy?
Well, yeah. And so the doctor analogy is, if you go into your doctor and your doctor knows that there's a 99.9% chance you're going to be dead in 6 weeks, does your doctor have a professional obligation to hide that information from you? I don't think so. In fact, we'd be appalled if the doctor withheld that sort of information from the patient and the family of the patient. You know, if it's a six-year-old, maybe you don't tell the six-year-old, but you tell the parents of the six-year-old that, you know, the cancer appears to be terminal, and in every other case on record, the patient has died within 4 weeks. So the time is short for this particular patient. Okay, so maybe you tell the parents. Well, we act as if, in this culture, we act in many cases as if we're all six-year-olds, as if we can't handle the evidence that is thrown our way. And so instead, we just cover our eyes and plug our ears and turn away. So I think that there are a lot of people in the media and in the government who are promoting malpractice and who are guilty of malpractice. They know what I know. You know, they're the equivalent of the medical doctors, and yet they won't transmit the information to the general public. Well, why not? You know, they know what I know about imperialism and what you know about imperialism, but nobody from the New York Times or MSNBC is going to go out there and tell the American public that they're in the midst of empire and that the empire has costs. Among those costs are we have to kill a lot of brown people so that we can continue to get the oil to sustain this set of living arrangements. Chris Hedges tried to point that out when he was a foreign correspondent with the New York Times, and we know how that worked out. You know, you can't tell the truth if you work for the mainstream media, not at the most fundamental level. You can't tell the truth if you work for a high enough level of the federal government. So we have become so accustomed to lies treated as truth and to misinformation or lack of information being trotted out to us that it appears we don't even care. It appears that we're not interested particularly in getting to the root of any number of predicaments we face. And so as the equivalent of the medical doctor on the climate change front, I'm just trying to tell people what I know based on the ability to connect a few dots.
And I think, and thank you for that, and I think that, and thank you for doing that, and I think also that the situation is even worse than someone who is merely in a terminal condition, because this culture is also wiping out lots of other species. So it's not merely that the person has a disease, but it's that they have some sort of disease that is also communicable. So it's not merely killing them, but killing everyone else. And there are, I mean, I have a good friend, John Osborne, who always says that the reason he does his work as an environmentalist is because as things become increasingly chaotic, he wants to make sure that some doors remain open. And what he means by that is if grizzly bears are gone in 10 years, they're gone forever. But if they're still here in 10 years, they may be here in 100. We don't know. And so far as what I think, and I completely agree with you on these feedback loops, but basically every 10 acres of old growth that you can help to keep standing that's 10 acres that's sucking up carbon. I mean, it may not be enough, but it's better than nothing. And these are 10 acres of habitat that is not there if it's cut, but it may be there, and we don't know. So my point is that it's even worse, I think, than somebody who's just dying of cancer. But instead, it's like, what would we say if there was a public health crisis where somebody dumped cyanide into the water, and now as a public health official, everybody gets mad at you for saying somebody put cyanide in the water and this could actually kill you if you drink it. Do you see what I'm trying to get at? It's larger than the personal then. It's the social. It's even worse.
Oh, absolutely. There's no question about it. And so this plays right into the notion of, quote, runaway greenhouse or runaway climate change. And when I talk about the global average temperature rising 5 or 6 degrees C in a decade or two, quoting Paul Beckwith, who in late November of last year indicated that we are in the midst of that sort of abrupt climate change. So when I point that out to people, they interpret that as runaway climate change, and it's the most horrible thing ever because we're all going to die. Well, almost certainly, all humans are going to die. But that's not the worst thing that could happen on this planet. The worst thing that could happen on this planet is that we continue the genocide of every other species on the planet until we bring ourselves to the point in the sixth great extinction that there aren't a significant number of other species to support any sort of ecosystems. Most people I talk to in the media assume that this whole set of living arrangements and all of habitat on Earth is really about us. And by us, I mean relatively wealthy heterosexual white men, and to a lesser extent, pretty much everybody else involved in the patriarchy. But I try to point out that maybe it's not only about us. Maybe we should take a little responsibility for the genocide and stop acting as if runaway greenhouse means runaway greenhouse for every species on the planet, when in fact, it, quote, only means runaway greenhouse for us and other large mammals and, you know, maybe a few hundreds or thousands of other species. But it would be hard to keep up with the rate at which we're taking species into the abyss. So maybe we should take actions to terminate the root of the disease, which in this case clearly is industrial civilization.
Well, which brings up the next critique that of yours, and once again, I obviously get this too, which is, well, if you want to terminate civilization, that means that you personally want to kill 6 billion people, 7 billion people, and you want to commit genocide, and you hate human beings. And I unfortunately, I'm not particularly exaggerating on what is said.
No, I know. I know. I get that email message in my inbox on a pretty regular basis. And, you know, Jackson Browne wrote and released a great song before the deluge in 1974. And he was writing about the end of industrial civilization. And it appeared in 1974 that the whole system teetered on the brink. This was 4 years after the United States ceased being the world's swing supplier of oil. And instead, there was this first oil crisis, which broke out in 1973 when it became very obvious to everybody concerned that the United States could no longer provide enough oil to keep the whole system running. Okay, so that's more than 40 years ago. And had industrial civilization ceased at that time, 1974, there wouldn't have been 7.2 billion people at risk. Instead, there would have been about half that many. So my point in bringing that up is that every day we add more than 200,000 people to the planet. That's births minus deaths. Every day we make everything worse for every other species on the planet and also for a whole bunch of individuals of our own species. So at what point do we say stop? Yes, ceasing industrial civilization will lead to the early deaths of a whole bunch of people. We don't know how many, but it will be a lot. And that doesn't mean that I want all those people to die earlier than they otherwise would have. It's just a recognition that we're an overshoot, and the basis, the root of the overshoot lies in civilization. So let's get to the root and stop acting as if this whole thing is about more. More humans, more consumption, more transferring the living planet into bricks and mortar so we can build more buildings and have more money and on and on and on. It's all become about more. My favorite line from a movie I haven't seen, Mary Poppins, is enough's as good as a feast. And I thought it actually originated in that movie, but I was reading Emil Zola's classic Earth from a few hundred years ago, and I found that exact line in there, enough's as good as a feast. But we haven't acted that way for a really long time. And industrial civilization allows us to act as if we can have infinite growth on a finite planet with no consequences. Well, of course we can't.
Well, and thank you for all that. And I want to add a couple things. One of them is that I just read yesterday that in the last 10 years, excuse me, in the last 10 years in Colombia, there have been 1,800 indigenous people murdered and 84,000 displaced in just the past 10 years. And so first, you know, all the people who complain about us wanting to stop this means we want to kill people. I don't hear them talking about that. And I don't hear them talking about it's like I asked Anuradha Mittal about 15 years ago if the people of India would be better off if the global economy disappeared. And she's laughed and said, of course. And there are now former granaries of India that now export dog food and tulips to Europe. And just last fall, I asked at Earth at Risk, I asked Vandana Shiva, well, what about the people who live in the cities? Aren't they going to starve? And she said, well, if you want instant land reform, kick the corporations out. The people will leave cities immediately and go back and take back the land that was taken from them. And this is not to say that we aren't an overshoot. Of course we are. It's just to say that there is there are blinders on as to you know, the people who say this are always talking about supporting the system. And besides which, I always say, look, if what you really care about is how people are going to survive through the crash, then what you need to be doing is working on local food supplies right now. And, you know, make it so people will have something as much as they can to try to soften that crash, because it's going to come no matter what you or I do. And besides which, we're not actually – all we're doing is like a doctor. It's like – it's once again like the doctor just saying, here, this is the situation, and now we need to actually look at reality and figure out what we're going to do given the situation. I've never understood the genocide claim at all. It makes no sense to me.
Right. And in anticipation of the crash to come, I turned my life upside down. You know, one of the reasons I left active service at the university, in addition to it being yet another cog in an irrevocably, irredeemably corrupt culture, one of the reasons I left was that I could foresee what was coming. And so a lifelong academic at the age of 49 started turning himself into an organic grower, a gardener. And so now here on this 2.7 acres, we have bees and root cellars and an extensive orchard and huge gardens and that whole thing. And so all I've done is shown a way that people can take responsibility in light of the profound changes to come. I sort of bank everything on that. Other people are perfectly capable of doing the same or taking less significant steps in the same direction. As you point out, contributing to the local food system as well as the continued delivery of clean water to people are pretty significant steps. And there's a lot there. It's almost never just one thing to make sure those attributes necessary for our survival keep coming to us. So there are dozens of things people can do to ensure that the water, the clean water, keeps coming to them. Instead of constantly bemoaning our fate and counting on somebody else to fix it when the change comes. That doesn't make a lot of sense to me.
Well, that seems to be part of the heart of it, is that what we're both, I think, actually demanding is that people take responsibility, by which I don't mean take responsibility for the destructiveness, because you and I aren't causing it. The system is causing it. But take responsibility in terms of responding to the situation itself. I mean, really, that's all we're both asking for, isn't it? Is that people face reality as best we can and respond to it.
Yes, absolutely. Instead of constantly capitulating to the, quote, powers that be, the people we blame for getting us in these dire straits, to actually get us out of them. And that's mostly what I hear and read, is that people are not willing to take responsibility for themselves and instead are depending upon somebody else to solve the problems created by somebody else. It doesn't make a hell of a lot of sense when you put it like that, does it?
Well, but and that actually brings up the third critique, solving problems, which is this culture is really, really good at solving problems. Like if you have bugs eating your plants, then you can apply pesticides and voila, short term, you've gotten rid of bugs. Long term, of course, you create other problems. But the point is that we're too clever to either trigger or allow climate change, and we will figure out a way. We being the technocrats, of course.
Right.
So you're just plain wrong, I've heard, because you have no faith in technology to solve the problems.
Yes. I hear that quite regularly, but it's pretty clear based now on quite extensive work by Tim Garrett at the University of Utah that only collapse of civilization prevents runaway climate change. And several people wrote to me and said, he can't really mean that. So I'm sure you're misquoting him. And so I wrote to him directly and asked him, is this what you mean? Do you mean the collapse of civilization? Do you mean no food at the grocery store, no fuel at the filling station, and no water coming out of any municipal taps? Is that what you mean? And he says, yes, that's what I mean, the collapse of civilization. You know, this whole set of living arrangements that we've come to not only depend upon, but treat as our entitlement. And so he makes it clear that civilization is a heat engine, and that to turn off the heat, we need to turn off civilization. And that's just one of the many artifacts of civilization that threaten the entire living planet with utter destruction. It's not just runaway climate change that we're talking about, or runaway within the context of human lives. It's runaway extinction. It's runaway erosion. It's runaway fouling the air and dirtying the water. I mean, pick your poison. The poison's everywhere.
And so I once again completely agree with you, but can we come back and actually address it directly of address the critique of we're too clever to trigger it? So can't there be, and once again I agree with you, but I'm can't there, and I don't even want this, I think it would be the worst thing that could happen in the world, but can't there be some sort of miracle techno cure that will suddenly suck all the carbon and methane out of the atmosphere and pump it into salt mines and hold it forever?
Right. In fact, there could be. You know, there could be that we overcome the most looming limit to economic growth. It could be that we manage to pull off a techno miracle and therefore avoid dealing with the reality to come. But then what? You know, Garrett Hardin pointed out many, many, many years ago that the ecologically literate question is, and then what? And it's never been more applicable than right now. So what if we are able to overcome some sort of limit to economic growth in the short term? So what? Do you think we won't have another one? That's absurd. You can't have infinite growth on a finite planet with no consequences. You can't have infinite growth on a finite planet, period. And you certainly can't get away with trying to grow the economy without adverse consequences for the living planet. So yes, we might, in fact, be able to overcome conventional oil, for example, limiting economic growth. And it appears that we did. And we did that by fracking. Now, that turned out to be a beautiful thing, didn't it? So hydrofracking for oil and gas has, in the near term, allowed the United States to yet again become the world's leading supplier of oil, just like the United States was in the early days, the 1930s through the early 1970s. Well, about 1970. But so now we move on to what's called the tight oil through fracking and tar sands and so forth, and the costs are horrific in terms of the environment. But we tend to look the other way on that, of course. Well, what's next? You know, at some point, there are limits, period. At some point, there's no more. There's no juicy nougat in the middle of the earth spewing out more and more that we can extract at a financial cost that makes any sense. So at some point, there are limits. We've known this for a long time. Julian Simon got into a famous bet with Paul Ehrlich about it a really long time ago, and Julian Simon won the bet, but along the way, he said something to the effect of, we can continue to grow the human population at the current rate for the next 7 billion years. And if you project that out, you know, the human population long before then becomes larger than the entire universe. So supporting that on one little planet might be a little problematic. And really, that's where we are. You know, the Limits to Growth study published in 1972 by the Club of Rome indicates where we would be at this point in history. And what do you know? We're there.
The next critique I've seen of your work is that, well, it can't happen that fast. Yeah, there's going to be global warming, and probably our grandchildren are going to have to deal with, or great-grandchildren, or you know, somebody 70 years down the road, but it ain't going to happen in 10 years. I think that's just a product of your fevered imagination.
Right. And again, my fevered imagination includes imagining what other people say. So Paul Beckwith has studied historical events and prehistorical events, really, and concluded that, and he reached this conclusion about 3 years ago, the conclusion that abrupt climate change is the rule, not the exception. And as a consequence, we could, emphasis on could, experience a 5 to 6 degree global average temperature rise within a decade or two. And he even posited more recently, November of last year, that we are in the midst of abrupt climate change, and we could see not only a 5 to 6 C temperature rise within a decade or two, but in fact could see the temperature rise to about 11 degrees centigrade higher than it is right now. And that's consistent with the geological record, in which we have a few relatively stable points in planetary history, and the temperature changes between those stable states occur quite rapidly, on the order of a few decades, not a few centuries. So the global average temperature of the planet could stabilize at 5 or 6 C above where it is right now, or at 11 or 12 degrees centigrade above where it is right now, and those changes could occur very quickly, and in fact are likely to occur quite quickly based on the geologic record. So it's not as if we're making this stuff up. I'm just quoting the scientists who are working in the field. There's a paper by Wright and Schaller in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences from now nearly 2 years ago, pointing out a 5 C temperature rise in a span of 13 years, 55 million years ago, the last great extinction event on the planet. And that paper has, as of this month, come into question in a relatively minor journal article. But the point is that it's perfectly feasible that the planet could experience a profound rise in temperature in a very short period of time based on events that have occurred in the past, and that's without the four dozen or so self-reinforcing feedback loops underlain by industrial civilization.
You know, one of the things that makes me really angry about all of this, and angry also about the critiques thrown at you, is that I got my degree in physics in 1983, and in 1982, I had a junior level physics class on solar heating and cooling. And I specifically remember I can see the professor standing at the board and making a sine wave and talking about various places where temperature on the Earth are stable, and talking about runaway global warming, where it runs away to the next stability point. And my point is, this is 1983 or 1982, and then also people were writing about industrial civilization causing global warming, at least I know of 1830s, and you probably know them for going further back. And this is an incredible amount of time wasted that could have been put to good use. It's like a doctor knowing that smoking causes cancer when somebody is 16 and they don't tell them until they're 63, you know? Or they tell them when they're 16, but they don't listen until they're 63 or something. The point is that there is a lot of time that has been wasted, and I don't see us in many ways as particularly that far ahead rhetorically from where my physics teacher was in 1982.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. In fact, you know, that's 10 years after the Club of Rome warned about limits to growth. And it's couple of centuries after George Perkins, naturalist and U.S. ambassador, warned about burning fossil fuels and that leading to increased warming of the planet. So, you know, we've known so much of this information, if not in the details, then in the general outline, for so long, it's absurd. And so, again, you know, the notion that civilization doesn't have costs, that there aren't consequences for the way we live, is absurd. You would have to actually be willfully ignorant to posit that statement. And yet I hear it all the time. How could you not know at this point, if you're a reasonably educated human being, how could you not know about the sixth great extinction being underway and proceeding considerably faster than any of the previous extinction events? How could you not know that there are horrific consequences for our collective behavior with respect to other species, and also, more importantly, the habitat for those other species? So when we talk about a system that can completely destroy the soil, the air, and the water, and somehow convince people that none of that is being destroyed, that's remarkable.
It is absolutely remarkable. And I guess two things. One of them is that, back to the we want to kill lots of people trope, that one of the things I think about a lot is that if somebody would have listened back with George Perkins Marsh, people could still eat pasture pigeons on the East Coast, and people on the West Coast could still eat salmon. And so every day that goes by, not only – and of course you know that I love salmon for themselves. I love all these non-humans for themselves. But that doesn't alter the fact that every day that passes is reducing the support system that enables humans to live. Not the support system, but the life system. It's reducing the vitality of the planet such that humans will have a more difficult time living as well. Once again, I care about the oceans more than I care about humans. But – even from an anthropocentric perspective, this is just stark raving mad. And that leads to the last question, really, the last major critique, and then also I want to comment something else after that. But the last major critique is that even though they're the ones who are actually killing, you know, destroying the air, destroying the water, polluting everything, then you get called an extremist. And I just find that extraordinary, that you get called an extremist, and then also aligned with that is that you used to work at you used to be a university professor, and you quit that, and now you are making money by scaring people. Can you address both of those?
Yeah.
Here's the question. Can you address both of those without laughing?
Whoops, too late. you know, it's true that my position is extreme. I will grant that. Taking the literal definition of an extremist, that I'm there, because I collect the facts that, and then point to the likely outcome in a way that nobody else is willing to do. So if that makes me an extremist, and apparently it does, then I don't mind the label even. I prefer the label radical, because I'm getting to the root instead of extremist, but whatever, that's a minor point. And then this notion that I gave up a six-figure job at which I was not required to come to work ever to tap into all of my retirement savings for the previous 20 years and live on a homestead where I make exactly $0 in the last 5.5 years is kind of absurd. In fact, I currently operate under a gift economy. I only request that people provide me gifts in exchange for my speaking and writing. And because this culture is so bizarre and so unaccustomed to something as historically normal as a gift economy, the return on that investment is considerably less than 5%. I usually get my expenses covered when I go on a speaking tour, But that's it. I'm not making any money at this. I currently have a big fundraising campaign going at Nature Back Left, and it's generated me a salary of $135 a month. So compare that with the $8,000 or $9,000 a month I was making before I gave up on industrial civilization. And it's pretty apparent that I'm not in this to scare the children just so I can make money. In fact, the opposite is obviously the case.
Well, and it's really funny, too, because at the same time they're saying, oh, nobody wants to hear doom and gloom, they're saying that you're doing this to basically sell out. And it's like, no, if I wanted to sell out, I would actually be saying something people want to hear.
Right. In fact, I suspect I would be on some sort of mainstream media outlet at least once a week if I would finish my interviews or finish my presentations with, okay, it's really awful, it's really dire, it looks like Habitat for Humans is going away soon, unless we do these three things. If I would present those three things, I have no doubt that I would be considerably more popular than I am today. The fact that the evidence doesn't indicate there are those three things, that they don't exist, is yet another case of me presenting the evidence for an outcome that people don't want to hear. So where does that land me? That lands me, again, in financial poverty and an inability to get the word out in mass because the resistance is so strong. We're a fix-it-up culture. You know, we're a do-it-yourself sort of Americans can do. That's the myth we've heard. That's a big part of this American exceptionalism lie that I've heard my entire life, that we can fix anything. We just put our minds to it. We can turn anything around. Well, that's actually not the case. You can't bring back a species after you've driven to extinction. And that's 150 to 200 species at least a day. So today, there's no bringing back the 150 species we've already driven to extinction today. There's no turning that around. I don't care what kind of high-caliber engineer you are. I don't care how much money you get paid to fix the bridge. You cannot undo extinction. And similarly, you can't undo the particles we put into the air at temporal spans that matter. You can't undo carbon dioxide in the atmosphere at any sort of scale that matters. And so the notion, the myth, again, that we can fix anything through engineering, no matter how badly we broke it, is just ridiculous. And yet, cultural programming has taken us right to that point. It's surreal.
So I guess I have two things. We have just a couple minutes left. I have a couple things. One of them is, I think, and I know you know this, but I think part of the reason that you are not listened to more and that you are not, that you are attacked is because you have made your loyalty to the real physical world and a physical reality rather than to the culture. And I think really that's what all the critiques boil down to is your loyalty is to the real world. And we don't like that.
Well, that's right. It's pretty obvious through daily actions that most people in this culture have no love for the living planet.
Yeah.
So that I prefer to remain immersed in reality as opposed to the, as you coined it, the culture of make-believe. It makes me the nail that sticks up and therefore that gets pounded down. Reality is a horrible thing to face. You know, the enlightenment process or the acceptance of reality process is not particularly enjoyable. Adyashanti pointed out many years ago and I'm going to quote here, make no mistake about it, enlightenment is a destructive process. It has nothing to do with becoming better or being happier. Enlightenment is the crumbling away of untruth. It's seeing through the facade of pretense. It's the complete eradication of everything we imagined to be true. And that's one of the horrible things your work did for me, was cause me to see through the things that are untrue. And it's not enjoyable. It's not all rainbows and butterflies and going to the mall and to the water park and living it up in a hedonistic lifestyle. Enlightenment isn't like that. It's a horrible thing. It's pretty easy to understand why most people embedded within this culture don't want to go down that path, because it is a horrible thing. As Aaron Dottie Roy points out, once you see it, you can't unsee it.
So despite your last, what you said about how you would be on all these mainstream media outlets if you would just give the three things you want people to do, what, and I'm not meaning this in terms of do, or maybe I am, so what do you want to have happen? Somebody hears this interview today, and sorry, I hope that you take this in the spirit in which I say it, but so what do you want them to do?
Right.
And
that's a great question. And out these little episodes called The Edge of Extinction at my blog at Nature Back Blast. And they're just little 1 to 3 minute video clips as I talk into the camera. And I think there are two questions here. What do we do? And what do you do? What do we do as a society? And it's pretty clear that what we are doing as a society and what we will continue to do as a culture is to destroy every aspect of the living planet. But we as individuals don't have to participate in that. We as individuals do not have to go along with the status quo and kill everything for the sake of killing everything. We can reach some state of enlightenment instead. So what do we do culturally? I'm not sure. We need a complete replacement of the culture. What do we do as individuals? Well, a couple of things. What do you love? And I ask people this all the time. When I meet people, you know, the standard approach is, hi, nice to meet you. What do you do? And the question, of course, is what do you do to make money in this omnicidal money-generating culture? And so after I tell people that I do crazy things like take care of bees and milk goats and raise gardens and occasionally I speak in public, in addition to all those things, then I end with, what do you love? And if they haven't run out of the room screaming at the list of things I do that are incredibly countercultural, that last question certainly caused them to just take a few steps back. What do you love? That's weird. Why would you talk about that? So I think what we do as individuals, and what I promote people to as individuals, is tap into what they actually love. And I suspect for most people that is not part of this culture. They don't actually love going to the mall. They don't actually love going to the water park. They don't actually love driving to work to a meaningless job to make money so they can drive to work and stay in a shitty apartment and so on. That's not what they love. And so I'm just asking people to tap into what they love and pursue some wise words looping back again to the medical profession from a long time ago, first do no harm. So that doesn't sound like much, but by asking people to treat each other with decency, I think that's something. By asking people to treat each other with respect, I think that's kind of a big deal. To pursue what you actually love instead of a few more dollars so you can go to the nearest fast food restaurant, I think that's doing something as well. So those are the sorts of directions I try to point people in, rather than the absurd culture that most people are embedded within and can't seem to break away from, that has them just chasing the next dollar.
Well, thank you so much for that, and thank you for your work, Guy. And I'd like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Guy McPherson. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.
Thank you, Derek. I appreciate the opportunity again.